Quicksu, your invisible force field. It's our only chance.
Hey there, welcome to Marvel Way of the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
And what a week it has been. We celebrated our birthday last week, which was just wonderful. Got to see some Mystery Science Theater live and in person, which is always a treat. we are nearing the end of season two. We've got a few great guests lined up for upcoming episodes. Some of them you've met, some of them you have not met yet. But the exciting announcement about the season two finale is it's going to be our first ever live show.
Yeah. Oh, man.
How are you feeling about that?
It can't be any worse than Marvel by the Minute.
How about Marvel by the Minute live in front of a
I'm
few
totally
dozen
excited
people?
Excited about that. I am, based on, you know, my other performing just sitting there talking to people that want to hear us talk about comic books. That sounds fun.
Yeah. And you're into public humiliation.
Yeah,
so,
I've put myself out there depressingly hundreds, maybe thousands of times.
At least this one's not going to end with you leaping into a drum kit.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Probably not. I don't think there's a drum kit nearby.
No, hopefully not. But yeah, our first ever live show is going to be Saturday, February 29th at 6 p.m. at Books with Pictures on Southeast Division Street in Portland, Oregon. It's going to be a free show, but space is limited, so please do not sleep on this. There is a Facebook invite that you can RSVP to from either the Books with Pictures Facebook page or from our Facebook page. I think we're going to try to put together some sort of after party somewhere in Southeast Portland. Mm-hmm. We've got a couple ideas that we're kicking around. We will share the details for that as soon as we know them. So hopefully we will see you at one or both of those things, on Leap Day.
Yeah. The bonus day.
I know. Yeah. It's a free day. So, I mean, why not throw a live show out there? Because, if it winds up being absolutely terrible, we don't have to ever revisit it next year. So
yeah, the anniversary comes fewer times.
Exactly. I really want to give big thanks to Katie Proctor, who owns Books with Pictures, for extending this very generous invitation to us. She has just been a delight to know, and she's been very supportive of the podcast. She runs a great shop. Please go in there, buy some comics from her. Tell her we sent you. If you get in there before the end of January, you can check out the curated shelf of comics that we put together.
Yeah, that looks awesome.
Yeah.
Nick drew this caricature of us too. So you just go in, head to the back corner on the right. There's a full shelf of all of the picks that we made. I don't think we put that out there too. We can, you know, give the list of what we chose for our curated shelf. But yeah, there's a lot of good stuff, of the sort of nuggets of where Marvel came from and where Marvel is now.
Yeah. And, you know, folks who were responsible for, you know, launching this whole thing that we are such huge fans of, and also folks who have really kept it going and kept it vital throughout its, 80-year history at this point.
Yeah.
That's wild to think about. So and we also have another exciting announcement, and I feel like you should be excitingly announcing this one because you're the person who's done all the heavy lifting on it.
That's such a funny pun. We are getting very close to the next t-shirt design. So I mentioned those were some of my goals for the year in the last podcast to get to making some more shirts for Marvel by the Month, and this is or Marvel by the Month adjacent. It's just our sort of geek shirts. But yeah, this one is it's a thing we love to say and a thing we love to do, and it will feature some Norse mythology elements, and I really love how it's coming together.
I remember kind of like throwing the idea out there and then just watching you run with it, and just improve on it in every way and bring it to life has been such a delight. I love watching you work anyway, so I'm very excited to share this with the world. When it is ready, we will put it out on Instagram, so follow us at Marvel by the Month. We'll also probably shoot that up on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Marvel by the Month, so follow us there and be first in line to get a look at it when it's ready.
Yeah.
Well, that's our business out of the way. shall we get into the podcast that we do here talking about the Marvel comics?
Well, first, I think before we do that, even we just better talk about history that happened when the Marvel comics came out.
Oh, that's good. We should get a little sense of historical context. So This month's comics are all cover dated December 1964. We have made it to the end of 1964, sort of.
Yeah.
Because of the production delay and the way that newsstand dates work, these were hitting newsstands in October of 1964. Uh-huh. So we're not quite out of that year yet. Let's give the folks a little glimpse into what was going on in the world when these issues came out.
Sure. So I'll jump straight to Beatles by the month.
Oh, please do.
We have the whole month of October, late September and October, they were recording Beatles for Sale. They've wrapped up recording in October. During that recording, they recorded She's a Woman at the EMI Studios in Abbey Road. And on that same day, drummer Ringo Starr passed his driving test.
Oh, congratulations, Ringo.
It probably took a while.
He kept driving on the right side of the road. It's like, no, Ringo. Well, that's great. Two major accomplishments in one day. That's good multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
The next week, on the 14th of October 1964, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev was removed from office. The Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union voted to retire him from his position as the party's general secretary, and the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet voted to accept his voluntary, let's put that in quotes, retirement as chairman of the Council of Ministers.
Presidium of the Supreme Soviet sounds terrifying.
That's pretty, yeah, it's pretty secret society stuff there.
Yeah.
He was the chairman of the Communist Party and also the prime minister of the Soviet Union. So those two roles he held jointly.
That's like a board of directors voting, you know, the person who created a company out of the company.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And among the offenses charged against Khrushchev were that he had tried to develop a cult of personality, that he had presided over the nation's economic decline, that he had brought the Soviet Union to the brink of war in the Suez, in Berlin, and in Cuba, and that he had insulted his colleagues and the nation's foreign allies. So, which is, you know, I think we're 3 for 4 right now in America.
Yep. Possibly all. I mean, except for the accuracy of Suez.
But, right. Yeah. The Central Committee then installed Leonid Brezhnev as the new Communist Party leader, and Alexei Kosygin became the new premier. The news of Khrushchev's ouster was not revealed to the Soviet public or to the rest of the world until an October 16 statement in Pravda. So for 2 days, no one knew that Khrushchev was out of a job.
Wow. Also on that same day, on the 14th, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. became the youngest recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in opposing segregation with nonviolent resistance.
Good for him.
Yeah. And although King was the fourth most admired man in America in 1964, according to Gallup, his approval rating that year was 43% positive and 39% negative before falling to an even split of 45% to 45% in 1965. So, you know, you can win a Nobel Peace Prize and still not rate very high during the 60s.
Yeah.
If you're trying to, you know, work for civil rights.
Yeah. Those numbers actually get even worse. Basically every year until his death, which is just, it's wild to think of, but there's no question that he is viewed much more positively now than he was at the time.
Yeah. Well, hopefully everyone thought about him and enjoyed a day off if you had one at the place you work.
Yes. And hopefully got a little service in there. On the 16th of October, 1964, the People's Republic of China became the fifth member of the Nuclear Club.
Woohoo!
After the United States, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and France, they successfully exploded an atomic bomb at a desert test site in the Xinjiang region. We've talked about how you can see a lot in the Iron Man stories that feature the Mandarin, how there's a lot of anxiety around atomic secrets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Will the Mandarin provide them to communist China? Well, apparently he did because they got the bomb. And now, you know, that absolutely shifted the geopolitical axis in China's favor. So,
yeah, but yep. But that didn't work out for them at all in the long run.
Yeah, yeah. no, not at all.
On the 23rd, David Box, who took over as lead singer for the Crickets after Buddy Holly died in a 1959 plane crash. David Box died in a plane crash at the age of 21. Wow. So that's a bad curse. Yeah, one of the people who I admire as much as the Beatles is Buddy Holly.
Oh, like, and, yeah.
As the founder of rock and roll as we know it.
Yeah, and they were huge admirers of Buddy Holly as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if he didn't invent the formula, he perfected it. So.
Yeah, and he, yeah, certainly. I've heard a ton of covers of early Beatles playing, you know, in bars playing Buddy Holly songs. It's yeah. Awesome.
Well, I'm going to wrap up with something that happened on the 27th of October, 1964. A washed-up actor by the name of Ronald Reagan, who hadn't had a film role in 7 years, appeared in a nationally televised speech that served as a springboard for a reasonably successful political career. Meh. The speech, which was later referred to as A Time for Choosing, which just, that sounds like such a Simpsons joke. it was red meat for conservatives. It had lines like, "Either we accept the responsibilities for our own destinies or we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan ourselves." What? The response was so enthusiastic that it raised more than $500,000 for the Republican Party in 1964 dollars, which would be over $4 million in 2020.
Wow.
And, you know, obviously it spawned a whole movement, conservative movement in America, and ultimately led to Reagan being president. So
it may have ensured that capitalism's still going strong, too. Yeah.
Strong is a strong word. But
yeah, I mean, it's going.
It's going.
It's an ongoing thing that we are all part of in within, you know, our neighborhoods in this place called the United States of America.
Hasn't devoured itself yet. Okay, well, on that uplifting note, let's take a pause. We're going to take a little break here. And when we come back, we're going to put Rob in the Marvel by the Minute chamber. Enjoy your last gasps of freedom before we seal you in there.
And atomize me.
All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It is time for Marvel by the Minute. As regular listeners of this podcast know, Marvel published way too many books every month for us to take a look at all of them in detail. We're going to go deep on two of them later on in the podcast, but everything else winds up in a segment we call Marvel by the Minute, where Rob has 60 seconds to summarize each issue and the rest of the week to examine his life choices. So the first book that we're going to talk about is Daredevil number 5. Title of the story is The Mysterious Masked Matador, which is written by Stan Lee and art by a new artist to Daredevil, Wallace Wood, colloquially known as Wally Wood, though apparently he hated the nickname Wally. Getting Wallace Wood to contribute to Marvel Comics was a big deal. He was a very well-established artist at the time. He'd done a ton of work in the Golden Age, and this is his first Silver Age Marvel Comics appearance. His first major work that he did, wasn't his first work, but it was his first major work, was at EC Comics, where he made his name illustrating especially EC's science fiction comics. Later on, he would do a bunch of stuff for Mad. He pretty much worked on every book that EC published in the early to mid 1950s. I've got a bunch of the horror comics that, you know, he did a story in. Like the science fiction was really his bread and butter. He actually was the motivating force behind William Gaines starting to publish science fiction in the first place. So that's really where he made his mark. He worked for pretty much every major and minor publisher. He worked for Marvel back in the Atlas days. He worked for DC Comics. He worked for, you know, pretty much anyone who'd pay him. He also launched one of the very first alternative comics, which is called Wit's End. He launched that in 1966. He was so prolific, and he was really known as a master of efficiency in the comics world. He created a reference guide called 22 Panels That Always Work, which is really just kind of quick reference for, you know, when a writer has put something into the comic script, and it's like a talking heads type thing. You know, here's a bunch of ways you can do that, and you can, you know, do slight variations on these formulas, they will not get old. It was widely circulated among comics freelancers for decades. It's a tremendously influential guy with a very long career. Unfortunately, his life ended extremely tragically. He suffered from chronic migraines his entire life, which is something I can sympathize with. He experienced kidney failure in the 1970s as a result of his lifelong alcoholism. He had a stroke in 1978 where he caused him to lose vision in one eye. That obviously severely impacted his ability to work. And in November 1981, he committed suicide by gunshot.
Oh.
So, as Jack Kirby said, comics will break your heart.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys just unfortunately come to not great ends. The industry was not great for them. But there's no doubt that Wallace Wood was just absolutely one of the giants in the industry, left behind a phenomenal body of work. And Daredevil number 5 is one of those pieces. So I'm going to put 60 seconds on the clock. If you have recovered.
I'm going to stop crying.
Yeah. If you can sob your way through this.
Okay.
So yeah, this is the first appearance of the Matador, who you're about to tell us all about. Do you think you're ready?
I'm whatever.
Whatever.
I mean, my battle cry. Whatever.
All right. 60 seconds. Go.
Okay. So one, we get Wallace Wood's version of the new Daredevil costume, which is pretty much the only other costume besides the red one that anyone ever thinks of. It's exactly that costume. He streamlines everything. He fights the Matador, who is a Matador.
There's nothing
he has
complex
no other
about
power
that.
Other than to be a really good Matador. So he uses that to like throw like his cape over the windows of an armored car and then rob it and do things like that. He's but he's really fast, pretty strong. He really gives Daredevil a run for his money. They have a big fight at a party. Matt Murdock has to do some quick changing a couple of times to keep his identity secure, but people are getting suspicious. He also finds out that Foggy's going to propose to Karen Page, although he loves Karen Page. And eventually he wins against the Matador?
Close enough.
Does he win?
Yep,
he does. He rams him like a bull. I forgot. That was a nice... And this is a beautifully drawn issue.
Like, yeah.
We've had 5 issues, and this is the 4th artist. So it's nice to see it so clean and well-plotted. And there's scenes on like a fire escape fight that look awesome.
Oh, yeah, It's top-notch stuff. Wood knew what he was doing. Not that there's really been a lot, there hasn't really been a bad Daredevil artist so far, but you're right, it has been sort of a revolving door.
Mm-hmm.
Wood's only going to be on the book for a few issues, so
right.
Enjoy the next few before he moves along. Okay, that was pretty all right. Let's move on to Tales of Suspense number 60. We have 2 stories here. The first is an Iron Man story, the second is a Captain America story. The Iron Man story is Suspected of Murder, written by Stan Lee, with art by Don Heck, inked by Dick Ayers. This one is Iron Man versus the returning Hawkeye and Black Widow. Move on to the Captain America story, which is called The Army of Assassins Strikes, written by Stan Lee, with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Chick Stone. It's Captain America versus Zemo's Army of Assassins. We have 60 seconds on the clock. Are you ready?
Whatever.
All right, go for it.
Okay, so the Iron Man story basically picks up after the encounter with Hawkeye, although I think we've had other stories in here. We have Iron Man, Tony Stark has a malfunction, so he has to keep the armor on. So basically Tony Stark has disappeared and everyone's asking Iron Man where he is. And Iron Man has to say, he's fine. He wrote me a note that says he's fine. But essentially, everyone starts to suspect that he killed Iron Man. he fights with Hawkeye. Hawkeye does get away again. And Natasha gets taken back to Russia for punishment for not fulfilling her mission as a spy. Captain America fights a bunch of assassins.
Sent by Zemo.
I can't remember what happened there. I know that Rick Jones gets in the mix. So he starts to show his fighting prowess in judo. And I that's all I can remember.
Yeah, well, he beats them all up, and then he taunts Zemo through some sort of televisual screen.
But gets on TV to taunt him and call him a coward.
Yeah, yep. Which is great. Anytime you have a chance to do that for a Nazi war criminal, you should absolutely do that.
Yes.
Okay, speaking of Nazis and Captain America, let's move on to Sergeant Fury number 13. The title of this story is Fighting Side by Side with Captain America and Bucky. It's written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, making a return to Sergeant Fury, inked by Dick Ayers. So it's a Howlers story with guest appearances by Captain America and Bucky from the 1940s. So this is, I think, the first time we really get an extended look at Bucky as a character in the Silver Age. So, all right.
I don't remember this too well. I'm just going to say it. I'm really scanning right now. I'm stalling basically, but well, you know, you can jump in anytime, Brian. It'll be great.
You've got 60 seconds on the clock. Go for it.
Okay. That was almost enough time for me to figure out what their mission was this time, which I still don't know. but I know that, this starts off with, Bull, I think is his name. This, other sergeant who's a total jackass. He's harassing this private in a bar and smacking him in the head and getting in his face, and Fury gets in the way and starts a fight with him. So Fury gets in some trouble, but a huge bar fight happens. Then he gets sent off to go. He's already watched a movie about Captain America. He does, no one thinks much of him in the Howlers. They're like, he's just some, you know, fancy man. So they get sent off to assist them in a mission that I cannot remember exactly, but it's Nazis. And once they actually do some battle together and see each other, Fury gets it. He believes Cap is awesome and is his biggest fan pretty much after that.
Yep.
And they stop some Nazis, a thing called Einfall.
Yeah. Fury encounters Cap at least once in his civilian identity and doesn't recognize him.
Right. This is the private who is being harassed by this other sergeant in the bar is Steve Rogers.
Yes. Yep. And then he runs into him on a train when they're on the train infiltrating the town that the Nazis are shipping slave labor to. That's how they get in there. And then once they're there, they just unleash all sorts of chaos.
Yeah. I didn't do this enough justice, because it is really cool to see Cap in World War II with Bucky.
Yeah.
And the way it's done is just action-packed, but really interesting. Like, and Fury's like helping Cap after Cap does a big sacrifice. And I got really hung up on, there's another one of Kirby's collages.
Oh yeah.
When Project Einfall gets blown up, it's just this collage of like stuff being blown up. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's awesome.
Kirby went all out with the collages this month.
Yeah, there's quite a few.
Yeah, so the cover of Fantastic Four is a collage. There's a panel, or I think a full page in Fantastic Four that's a collage. There's something in Sergeant Fury. So he's really getting into experimenting with it. You can tell he's really enjoying doing these. So let's move on to Journey into Mystery number 111. This story is The Power of the Thunder God. This is a continuation of the two-parter from last month, where Thor is basically trapped inside of a trap-filled house with a supercharged Mr. Hyde and Cobra, and he has created a time vortex around the house because Jane Foster is critically injured. If time passes normally, she will die. So that's where we left off at the end of the last issue. If you are ready, we have 60 seconds waiting for you on the clock.
Yes.
Go for it.
Okay, so basically, we know this. We have this time vortex, and Thor can't let this down because he knows that there's only, you know, minutes or seconds or whatever until Jane Foster will perish. Odin's watching because he's watching his Earth TV. He loves the reality shows, so he basically says, you know what? He's reminded by Baldur, who's playing a cool song for him about how he used to love a mortal woman. So he decides he's going to send Baldur to find, I forgot the guy's name, something the healer.
Yeah. Hardal the healer.
And get the cure this mystical Asgardian cure and get it to Thor so he can save Jane. So Thor's reached the absolute last bits of his time with her, where he has to take down the time vortex when he receives Baldur's sword with the cure. And then there's the Tales of Asgard.
Yes. Dang,
I always forget about the Tales of Asgard.
Oh, I forgot to introduce that. Yeah, it's Tales of Asgard, The Secret of Sigurd, written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, inked by Vince Coletta. Thor fights a giant named Sigurd, who is invincible as long as he's touching the ground.
Yeah, he's an earth sprite.
Right. So Thor, like, sticks his hammer in the dude's belt, whips him around so his belt snaps, and, like, launches him toward an asteroid.
So he can't touch the earth.
Right.
And Loki, of course, tricked him into getting in a fight with him in the first place.
I mean, that goes without saying, really. I don't even know if we need to mention when Loki is responsible for something.
I thought that was a really dramatic issue, though, for the... I was like, wait, how is he going to get out of this?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I thought maybe he was going to change into lame Dr. Blake and they were going to put him over and let him save the day. But he was like, I don't think I can save her.
Yeah.
I'm going to try, but I think she's going
to
die.
So there's a moment in this issue, and it's when he is deciding to that he needs to bring the barrier down. And it honestly, it's the first time it really sold the whole, like, Jane Foster Thor relationship thing to me, where Thor is he's basically crouching down next to her. He's essentially making the decision to pull the plug on her. He knows what the consequences are. It's actually really touching. Like, he's sitting next to her, he's looking down at her, and he's like, Jane, my most dearly beloved, is this the price you must pay for having won the love of a god? Is this what Thor, son of Odin, has done to you? Mm-hmm. It's very tragic. Like, it's very weighty. He says, when the time warp is lifted, adored one, I shall again become Dr. Blake, and I shall try to save you with every ounce of my skill and strength that I possess. And if I fail, then we both shall die. For my heart will evermore be naught but a cold, withered ember if I should lose thee.
Yeah, like, it is touching.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just the other parts are like Thor getting really mad and probably endangering Jane's life more while he's trying to fight Hyde and Cobra.
Yeah, yeah. But he's got some stuff to work through. He's taking it out on the bad guys. Yeah. So, and he beats them so badly.
He does.
Like, it even mentions at the end of the issue, is like, well, we're not going to see them for a while.
Like, they're in traction. Yeah.
Okay, you're coming up on the end, man.
Okay.
We got Strange Tales, number 127. The first story is a Human Torch Thing adventure. The second is a Doctor Strange story. So the Human Torch Thing adventure is The Mystery Villain, written by Stan Lee, art by Dick Ayers, with inked by Paul Reinman. The Human Torch and Thing versus the Mystery Villain. And then the Doctor Strange story is the second part of last month's story. This one's called Duel with the Dread Dormammu, written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko. It's the continuation of the Doctor Strange versus Dormammu story. So the cliffhanger of last episode was the two of them are facing off in Dormammu's throne room, and it's about to go down. So 60 seconds on the clock. Feel free to spend like 10 seconds on the first story and then, you know, 50 on the rest. Go for it.
Okay. So we have the Marvel team up of Thing and Johnny. They decide that Reed is not a great leader and they could be the leader doing their normal thing. They go off. Then they learn about some competition for racing some car in the Salt Flats. They go to Utah. They encounter all of these crazy things. There's this crazy supervillain with a question mark on his face. Turns out it's Reed.
Yep.
He was just telling them he's better than them and smarter. And they were like, you are.
Because that's how friends treat friends.
Yeah. And then the Dread Dormammu. So Doctor Strange basically... and so we have Dormammu, who's so all-powerful and we're so terrified. And we've met Cleo, who keeps telling him this. She takes him around the universe to tell him that if Dormammu actually gets defeated, this barrier goes down and the mindless ones who surround this area will attack. So Doctor Strange has to help Dormammu put the barrier up to keep them from getting in as they're fighting. So he helps him, saves his life, which makes him have to give him a boon, basically.
Right.
Like, say, and which Doctor Strange asks, I know I'm past, but I'm just going to wrap it up. Doctor Strange asks for Cleo to be set free and for Earth to be left alone.
Yep. And Dormammu actually sticks to that.
He's so mad, though.
He's furious.
He's like honor bound to do this, but he's so mad that he was helped and that somebody defeated him.
Yeah, yeah. Dormammu abides by his vow not to invade Earth's dimension for like a decade in Marvel Comics. It's not until the Avengers Defenders War in the mid 70s that he actually starts trying to figure out how he can work around this. So, yep.
Break his contract.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
The other thing about this is we talked about it in a deeper dive last week.
Yep.
But it continues the just trippy, surreal, bizarre, weird world of the dark dimension. And it is so cool. And again, so much worth they're like trying to pick a panel. This was another thing where just every panel in this thing seemed like the best panel.
Oh, absolutely. And is this the one where at the end of it, the Ancient One gives Strange his new cloak?
Yeah.
His cloak of levitation. And the now he has the Eye of Agamotto as his pendant.
Yeah. So he's lost this blue cloak that he's had and now gets the red one that everyone's more familiar with.
He
pretty much gets his last accoutrement.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. He levels up. All right. We just have one issue left to go. This one is Avengers number 11, The Mighty Avengers Meet Spider-Man, written by Stan Lee, art by Don Heck, inked by Chick Stone. I'm going to preface this by saying the continuity on this one is a little bit wonky. Apparently production schedules got a little messed up or something. So this Avengers story actually takes place after all of next month's solo hero stories, so it's a little out of order, but there might be a pretty good explanation for why it's time-wise a little screwed up because Kang is back. So I'm gonna put 60 seconds on the clock. Walk us through it.
Okay, so Kang is back. He from his base of operations in the 30th century, he creates a robot duplicate of Spider-Man, a perfect duplicate with like webbing and sticks to walls.
That has Spider-Man's internal monologue also.
Yeah. And also, does banter when he's fighting. So he creates Spider-Man to this Spider-Man robot to infiltrate and destroy the Avengers. The real Spider-Man shows up and helps defeat the robot doppelganger. all kinds of nonsense ensues. And he says, did you think you could prowl the streets of New York impersonating me without my own spider sense warning me of your presence? So somehow he can just tell when there's a doppelganger.
That's a good power.
It's the first time Spidey has met the Avengers. And although he met them individually when they passed through as cameos in his annual.
Right.
But Iron Man is not a part of the story because he's investigating the death of Tony Stark. So he's not there.
Right. Yeah. So this month, Tony Stark is missing, but next month it appears that Tony Stark has died. So that's why I think there's a scene in this issue of the Avengers where they're all like, they're toasting Tony Stark, the man whose house this was.
They're talking about him as though he's gone.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's very weird and doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Until you realize this.
You're like, he's been missing for a couple days. Everybody just be cool.
Yeah.
And, I would say, I don't know. I liked the crazy robot Spider-Man doppelganger.
Yeah.
But every time Kang comes in, I just think, dude, you could do pretty much anything.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where there's just a supervillain so powerful that you can't understand how they can screw up all the time.
Right. Yeah. It's like, why are you Rube Goldberging this?
Right. It's not even a pride thing. Like, pride is a good reason why a supervillain can't win.
Kang's tragic flaw is that he's not very bright.
Yeah. He's got all the technology of the 30th century.
Right.
And he just can't somehow come up with a good enough plan. And he can travel through time.
Yeah. It's like, you know how this is going to end, dude. Oh, man. Okay. Well, hey, that was, I believe, a very successful Marvel by the Minute.
I'd say that's a D+.
That counts as very successful in our world. So we're going to take another break. When we come back, we are going to get into Spider-Man number 19 here on Marvel by the Month.
¶¶
here on Marvel by the Month, it's time to talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 19. The title of the story is Spidey Strikes Back. It's written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko. If you remember last issue, Peter Parker had given up on being Spider-Man because Aunt May had suffered another health crisis. But with Aunt May recovering and having inadvertently given him a pep talk, he is back in the red and blue, and he's ready to resume his web-slinging. So go ahead and start us off.
Yeah, so the story starts with Spidey dropping in and decking a gang of bank robbers in front of a huge crowd of onlookers. Like, he lays into these guys. In a nearby lecture hall, J. Jonah Jameson is about to give a speech entitled, of course, How I Prove That Spider-Man is a Cowardly Fraud.
The man can write a headline.
When someone tells him that they like whisper in his ear right before he's about to, you know, hit the lectern. When someone tells him, they tell him that Spidey's back in action and he finally loses the giant grin he's been wearing since last issue. The terrifying grin.
It
really reminds me of the Guy Fawkes mask from V for Vendetta.
It's it like, really does. Yeah.
It's just giant dimples.
Yeah. And it's such a satisfying, like, three panels.
Where watching
his
fade.
Face just fall. Yeah.
That's also just it's the nuance of how well these people can draw.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, you forget, but when you see this sort of sequence panels like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, the Human Torch is on his way home after his fight against the mystery villain from Strange Tales 127.
It's Reed.
So basically, Reed, to teach Johnny a lesson, messed with him so badly that he's running low on his flame power, which makes him an easy target for Montana of the Enforcers, who just so happens to be using an asbestos-covered whip that day for no reason. So the Enforcers wind up capturing the Torch with an assist from their new teammate, the Sandman. And I think until I saw this, I didn't really put it together. It's like, yeah, actually, if you're going to fight the Human Torch, having a guy made of sand is a good choice to have for someone on your team. So they imprison the Torch in a sealed glass cage, and they decide that if they beat the Torch that easily, well, Spider-Man should be no trouble at all.
I do love that they give him just enough oxygen to stay alive, but not to flame on. That's like a pretty good villain trap.
Absolutely, yeah.
Also weird, though, that the Torch was in Utah when he fought the mystery villain.
Right.
So he might be tired just from flying all the way back from Utah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, so later on his way home from school, Peter Parker sees Fancy Dan.
My favorite enforcer.
He changes into costume and follows him back to his headquarters. Unfortunately, members of the gang see Spidey on the ceiling, and Spidey winds up in a knockdown, drag-out fight against the Enforcers and a ton of hoods. The cops show up, and the Enforcers get away, but some of their gang gets arrested.
Yeah. So after this brawl, Peter changes back into his civilian clothes. He heads to the Daily Bugle, where Betty Brant is there, of course, and she introduces him to Ned Leeds, who she was on a date with in the previous issue. Peter is super chill about the whole situation. He's like, oh, nice to meet you, Ned. You know, and Betty is honestly a little bummed out that Peter's not more jealous about the whole thing. And
I was bummed out. He's so max chill.
He really is. And like, she's wondering, like, is he seeing someone else? Is that why he's so confident and so unfazed by this? and from Betty's perspective, if she was believing that Peter was kind of messing with her and maybe two-timing her, like, this is exactly not the reaction that she wanted to get. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe she's trying to tweak him a little bit, but, you know, he's definitely not rising to that bait. Peter's there because he wants to sell Jameson some pictures of his fight with the Enforcers, but Jolly Jonah is in a terrible mood and slams the door in his face. So he's back to being regular old Jonah.
Then we continue this sort of, I would call it a manic episode of Peter Parker, because he's just doing everything in this issue.
Like, well, they're definitely making up for no fights in the previous issue.
They promised they would. Yeah, and they are. Yeah, so Peter changes back into Spider-Man, swings by the Bugle to taunt Jonah, which is awesome. I love that that's just an ongoing thing already. He just comes by to give him some crap.
Yep.
And then he shakes down a stoolie for the location of Sandman and the Enforcer's hideout. Spidey heads to the hideout and sneaks inside where he finds the Torch. He sneaks in here perfectly. It's such a great sequence of him just crawling under the eaves and doing all this cool Spider-Man sneaky stuff.
And it's got Ditko doing the like the shadow work where like the blues of the costume are fading into black. So it's like you just see the red parts of his costume popping out from
and his eyes.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, it's good stuff.
It's real good.
But also he sets up his camera to take photos of the action and then it's go time.
Oh yeah. And this leads into a big, big fight. This goes on for several pages, like 5-6 pages where it's just Spidey, you know, bouncing from one enforcer to the next and Sandman and just generic hoods. And he's just, he's doing a great job. He's holding his own. And he's just starting to get tired, honestly. Like,
yeah, there's like 20 people he's fighting.
Yeah.
And 5 of them are pretty powered, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. This feels like one of the fights from the Spider-Man PlayStation 4 game. Like when you really have your technique down and you're just like going from one bad guy to the next, like this is what this feels like where you, or like the Batman,
he's building
Arkham
up
Asylum
a big
games.
Combo. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Where it's just like, boom, 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 like hopping from one to the next and just, you know, absolutely just making everyone look like a fool. But he is starting to get a little tired. As he's starting to wear down a little bit, he busts open the Torch's cage, and the two of them team up. They take out all of their foes, except Sandman. And the only reason he gets away is because Torch and Spidey wind up getting in each other's way, and they get tangled up in Spidey's webs. That's
classic superhero mix-up.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, it's kind of great because at first they're like, really buddy-buddy, and you're like, oh, maybe they're turning over a new page in their relationship, and then they mess each other up, and they're right back to bickering, so it's wonderful. But the Sandman is so exhausted from the fight. It wasn't just Spider-Man who was getting worn down, but Sandman is also pretty beat. He can't even get away from the cops when they show up. Like, he's just like,
I was like, can you just turn into a pile of sand? But apparently that takes a lot of effort too.
I guess so. Yeah. So like literally the cops arrest him. And I think that's the first time I've ever seen that happen.
I like that the cops capture him due to exhaustion. Yeah, that is a funny comic book. It's not something we see very often.
Yeah. Yeah.
Peter returns to the Daily Bugle and sells Jameson his photos. Jameson is, he's getting over his sadness about, you know, Spider-Man not being driven underground.
Yeah. He's not happy that Spider-Man's back, but he's delighted that Peter got the photos because they're going to help him sell just
half a million
more newspapers. Yeah.
He also manages to get a date with Betty the next day. She has a date with Ned that night. He's still chill about it.
Guess that's the way Peter rolls.
And as Peter leaves the Bugle, he's trailed by a shadowy figure who reports back to an even shadowier figure about what Peter's up to. Who are they? Find out next month, true believer.
Yeah. So like we mentioned earlier, this issue absolutely delivers on all the promises at the end of the last issue. You could tell that they were definitely making an effort to ensure that they packed as much action as they could possibly fit into this. It's a regular length story, but there's so much.
It feels like one of the annuals. It feels like a 48 page story.
It really does. Like Ditko's working with a lot of smaller panels. It's a lot of sort of like 7, 8, 9 panel grids. Mm-hmm. And I guess it is a 22 page story. So they added a couple more pages in there.
They didn't throw a pin up in or anything too. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. But they definitely wanted to make sure it's like, okay, you know, last issue was just something different we were doing. We're making up for all of it. And then some this issue. And it's a great issue. It's a lot of fun. So,
yeah, I agree. Just because of some of the detail going on, it took me a little bit longer to read than usual.
Yeah.
I had to break it up.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's Spider-Man. We've got one more issue to talk about this month. That'll be Fantastic Four number 33. So let's go ahead and take our final break of the episode. And when we come back, we'll talk a little FF here on Marvel by the Month. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We've got one more issue to talk about. It's Fantastic Four number 33. The title of the story is Side by Side with Submariner, written by Stan Lee, with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Chick Stone. This one is a team-up between the Fantastic Four and the Submariner, but he doesn't know it.
Yep. The story starts with Reed examining a grotesque, huge undersea creature in his lab. It's like laid out on a conference room table.
Yeah.
Just big, weird green thing with sort of Fin Fang Foom's face.
It's vaguely Lovecraftian.
Yeah, it is. It's disturbing. And everyone else seems to think so, too, in the Fantastic Four. The Coast Guard found it yesterday and brought it to Reed. They're like, this is a weird thing. Take it to the Fantastic Four.
I love that Reed has that sort of relationship with the Coast Guard. It reminds me of the scene in Ghostbusters when the cops just show up with possessed Rick Moranis. They're like, we don't know what to do with this.
We do not know what to do with this guy. He's your responsibility, private corporation. So Reed doesn't know what it is, but he knows it's from the deepest part of the ocean and something very unusual must have driven it to the surface. So he sends Johnny out to survey the coastline and see if he can find anything.
So Johnny heads out to the coastline to see what he can see. And he does see a shrouded figure rising out of the water. It turns out to be Lady Dorma, who we last saw in Fantastic Four Annual Number 1 when Namor invaded Manhattan. She has come to the surface world to enlist the Fantastic Four's aid because after returning to rule Atlantis, Namor was challenged by Atuma, a warlord from the murky depths who looks like a pretty good He-Man supporting character.
Yes, he does.
He's got sort of a aquatic skull helmet kind of thing. He's got like a bat wing vest, which is very fetching, and kind of a... What do you call, like, a kilt? It's sort of a kilt, or I don't know what you...
I'm not...
Like what Roman soldiers would wear. I don't know the name of that thing.
I don't know the proper nomenclature for that outfit. But and then weird, scaly gold leggings.
Right, yeah. So he is wearing pants.
Look tougher than they sound, but I guess.
Right.
They look tougher than Kraven.
Right, yeah. And he's blue-skinned like most Atlanteans are. So Atuma, he showed up at the gates of Atlantis, and he led his army in a civil war against Namor's forces. Namor, being Namor, leads the charge against Atuma, despite Dorma pleading for his safety, which prompts Namor to basically tell Dorma to shut up, because he's not the nicest guy all the time. And that causes her to betray him to Atuma, which is sort of her whole deal. Like, she's shown up twice, and both times she's betrayed Namor.
Yeah, she runs hot, and she also is willing to betray you.
Yeah.
Which, if she's bad.
Yeah, but she does, the reason that she does it because she's concerned for Namor's safety. She extracts a promise from Atuma not to harm Namor in exchange for helping him get into the city. But it becomes immediately obvious that Atuma has no intention of keeping that promise as soon as he's through the gate. So that's why she came to the surface.
So the FF, of course, are going to go help, because if Atuma conquers Namor, he will attack the surface world next.
Yeah, that's her pitch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that gets them more interested in other than just some, civil war going on in Atlantis.
Fish civil war.
But Reed doesn't need a lot of convincing. He's got a new OXO spray that he really wants to test. So he allows all of them to, this spray allows all of them to breathe underwater for a limited time, and even lets the torch flame on underwater. So it's like, I don't know, some magical extra oxygen.
Sure.
Ben immediately tests it out by sticking his head in a fish tank, which is just really funny.
It's one of my favorite scenes in the book, honestly.
Just suddenly, the first thing he does is he wants to test it, so he just tries to breathe fish tank water.
Yeah, and there's still fish in there, too.
It's kind of gross and hilarious. Then Dorma leads them to Atlantis by way of a Jack Kirby collage panel, which is weird.
Yeah. It's a really good one, too.
Yeah.
He's really getting the hang of these things.
It's a full page.
Yeah. Yep. So as the FF approach Atlantis, they're attacked by Atuma's forces. They have to abandon ship. Fortunately, though, the OXO spray works exactly as designed. They have half an hour to help Namor before it wears off.
Seems fast.
Yeah. But, half an hour of breathing underwater, I'd take it.
Yeah.
Reed disguises himself as a manta ray, and he transports everyone into battle. So the FF is attacking Atuma's forces from the rear, as Namor is leading the charge against them from the front lines. And this is one of the first times we get to see Namor just be heroic. He's a brilliant leader. He's a fearsome and fearless warrior, and he's extremely inspiring to his troops. It's really fun to root for him. Yeah. And it's the first time we've really had a chance to just unambiguously root for Namor.
Yeah, he's obviously a hero right here in this instance, briefly.
In this context, right. To his people, he is a hero. Yeah.
You have to really put a lot of qualifiers on there.
You do.
As the FF fight their way closer to the front, Reed tells them that they have to disguise their presence because Namor might assume that they're enemies and attack them as well. The FF dismantles traps that Atuma's army has laid for Namor, moving stealthily from one to the next like super Navy SEALs.
It's pretty good.
It's just them creeping around trying to not be seen by pretty much anybody, especially Namor, who they're helping.
They're like underwater commandos.
Yeah,
they're like the Howling Commandos of the deep sea.
Meanwhile, Namor finally makes it to Atuma and takes him on one-on-one. Namor wins the fight when Sue turns him invisible, which he doesn't know because he's too focused on the battle.
Right.
So this keeps Atuma from being able to blast him with hidden disintegrator rays. So Atuma's just cheating left and right.
Yeah.
Namor doesn't realize anything about being invisible. He doesn't notice. He's just too focused on the fight.
Yeah, nor does he realize that the Fantastic Four has been removing obstacles from his way.
Right.
Yeah. Namor is victorious, and the Oxo spray starts to wear off, so Reed stretches to the surface with his teammates. After banishing Atuma and his forces outside of the gates of Atlantis, Namor tells Dorma that he knows she betrayed him. And he says, "But I forgive you, for I, above all others, am aware of the strange things one may do in the name of love." And that, my friends, is about as close to an apology as Sue Storm will ever get from Namor.
Which isn't to Sue Storm, so there you go.
Yeah, exactly. But at least there is some... We understand for the first time that there is some cognizance in Namor's head that is like, yeah, I've done some messed up stuff.
Yeah.
I can't justify every decision I ever made.
A couple of kidnappings here and there.
Yeah. So this definitely marks a transition point in Namor's character. He's not exactly a hero yet, but there is at least a little bit of proof now that he has heroic qualities. So we'll take it.
Yeah, and then meanwhile, on the surface, Reed has transformed into a life raft for his teammates. Sue says, "Reed, my darling, you never fail us," which causes Reed to think, she still calls me darling, even after seeing Namor again. Perhaps I am the one she truly loves. So we get a little bit of the love story.
Yeah, again, this is, you know, maybe the closest that Reed gets to being an emotional human being.
Right.
The last time we saw Namor, when he had kidnapped Sue and Reed went down there to take care of business and get her back, that kind of advanced the love storyline between Reed and Sue. Started to move Namor out of the picture. Well, now Namor is being moved further out of the picture. This is really clearing the ground for Reed and Sue to get together finally, which will happen in the not too distant future. I mean, that's not a spoiler. That's Fantastic Four this month. I really like this issue. I really like any time we go to Atlantis and we get to see Jack Kirby doing renditions of everything, just looking so amazing and alien. And his imagination just going completely bonkers.
And there's a few of these scenes that really do remind me of that annual with Namor too. They're like, he spent some time on the detail. Chick Stone spent some time on some varied line thickness work that just makes it, I don't know, it just makes it seem like so much more premium art than some of the things we see.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that brings us to the end of the comics. The only thing we've got left to talk about now is our panels of the month. Shall I go first?
Sure.
All right. Because my panel comes straight from this issue, Fantastic Four number 33. It's toward the end of the issue, page 20, panel number 1. So this is when Namor is just beating the stuffing out of Atuma at the very end of the issue. For the first time, we see him fully committing to his regal bit. Fool, It is to Namor, the avenging sun, you speak. Namor, prince of the blood, sovereign of the seven seas. Like, we're really establishing Namor as he is a king. Like, this is who he is now.
It's his birthright.
Yes.
You must respect it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Very Shakespearean.
Yeah. It's a great issue. I, though, and I know you have this same affinity.
Oh, yeah.
Mine is from Strange Tales. This Doctor Strange, I did not know I loved Doctor Strange so much until we started reading all these.
Yeah.
Like, I'd always thought of him as sort of a secondary character. Like, Ditko in Spider-Man is one thing, but Ditko doing Doctor Strange is just this insane other introduction to a different art form almost altogether.
Yeah.
So my panel is in Strange Tales 127. It's page 16 or page 3 of the Doctor Strange story. It's panel 3. There's a bunch of panels in here that I had to, again, just deliberate over which one I wanted to pick. This one is our introduction to the mindless ones.
Yeah.
And we didn't really, because I didn't have a ton of time, we didn't talk about what the mindless ones are, but they're these rocky beings with no real head. Like,
they're like a golem or something.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
They're just giant hulking creatures. With no real face, this one big red eye that shoots a beam. So we see them, and they're just mindless ones. It's Cleo taking Doctor Strange through the Dread Dormammu's dimension.
Yeah.
And we see there's two guys in the foreground, right in the middle. They're shooting each other with these lasers out of their eyes, and they're on this path or floating island or some weird Ditko stuff, and it looks like Swamp Thing or Man Thing. For the Marvel world, it looks like Man Thing. It's like this swampy, weird globule. It's like, it defies words to see these things.
Yeah.
Obviously. I mean, not like everyone who listens to this knows I'm not the most well-spoken gent, but it is very hard to describe these things. Just seeing them is so mind blowing. And I love surrealism. I love Dolly. I love, you know, but this is like its own thing. It's just so cool.
They're and the mindless ones, like, knowing nothing about them, the fact that they're called the mindless ones and that even Dormammu fears them.
Right.
That's all you need to know.
Right.
And
there are other things that in Ditko's work, especially the way he like colors and lines his work.
Yeah.
The fact that he does control his own art, I think, is always the best.
Yeah.
Because he will vary his line work. He does these color combinations that are exquisite and very poppy. I mean, they're like the definition of pop, but they're in this cool, in his weird, you know, floating universe with just these different planes and these different lines. And I gush more about it. It's worth seeing. Even if the stories don't make any sense or you don't give a crap about it, just seeing what he's doing with these panels is amazing.
It's just a feast for the eyes. It's imagination run completely wild and just untethered from any typical reality. And the way that has also evolved. I mean, it feels like not that many episodes ago we were talking about Doctor Strange, like, mystical battles as being two guys staring at each other, you know?
Two ghost people staring at each other.
Right, yeah. And now, like, just seeing how it's exploded and blossomed, it's wonderful. And like you, I don't think I ever was a big Doctor Strange fan until we started, you know, looking at these in detail from the very beginning. And now, like, I honestly, I don't know if I am a Doctor Strange fan outside of Steve Ditko doing Doctor Strange.
Yeah, that might be the thing, too. I mean, I do think the character, especially the way they developed in recent, in the Marvel cinematic universe, is awesome. He's a great, it's so nice to have the magical element in that universe.
Yes.
But I've never been a fan, as I've said before, like, I'm more of a sci-fi guy over fantasy.
Right.
If I have two things to pick, it's going to be sci-fi.
Sure.
Although I'm very familiar with it because both are escapes from this reality. So I've spent plenty of time.
Yes.
I know my way around dragons, but this is its own thing. It's like watching a savant doodle with perfect control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't even know how to explain that.
Yeah. Treat yourself to reading some Steve Ditko comics today.
Yeah.
Well, that's our episode for this week. Thank you so much for listening. As always, in between now and next week when we come back at you, you can look us up online, marvelbythemonth.com. You can follow us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth and drop us an email, marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. And definitely keep your leap day free. We would love to see as many of you as possible February 29th, 6 p.m. at Books with Pictures for our first ever live show. And hopefully in the very near future, we're going to have some pretty rad merch to share with
you. Yeah, keep your eyes out. We will reveal it once I finish the polish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so good. I'm so excited for this. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
And we will see you next week for next month.